Hello, and welcome to Educause Now. I'm Colleen Luckett.
And I'm Jerry Bain.
Hey, Jerry, how about that annual conference this year?
Yeah, the Educause 2009 annual conference was one of the most successful we've had. And we saw so many participants from across the globe learning, networking, and contributing to some of the best thinking in higher ed IT. Thanks for making this one of our best annual conferences ever.
And there were some great speakers. In this episode, we feature conversations with two of the keynote speakers, Lawrence Lessig and Jim Collins.
Lawrence Lessig talks to us about terms of service for sites like YouTube, including copyright and fair use issues for educators.
And Jim Collins shares some insights.
If you'd like to learn more about what you hear on today's show, you can visit our show notes at www.educause.edu/now. You can also subscribe to our podcast on iTunes by searching for Educause. Jim Collins is an author and lecturer on business effectiveness and growth. His latest book is How the Mighty Fall and Why Some Companies Never Give In. He recently spoke to Bill Hoag, Vice President for Information Technology and CIO for the University of South Carolina, by phone after his keynote address at this year's Educause annual conference.
I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what you see in the coming generation and also what we who in many instances are moving into the latter stages of middle age might be able to do in turn to help nurture that growth of that next great generation.
Well, it's a nice question. First, I believe that there are many great generations in American history. So as I interact with this young generation, they have a tremendous commitment to collaboration, and they take it as a given, not as a possibility or a nice to have, but as a given that they should always, throughout their lives, be thinking not just about their own situation, about their own success, but about something larger than themselves and the way in which they contribute back to the way the world works. And I think that this is certainly perhaps distinctive from my generation, which we tend to think of it as, okay, maybe you get to that later in life, but it's not necessarily something that is integral to your life every step of the way. And I think this generation really has that. That said, I think that where we can be helpful, we're going to need to help them have confidence that they can continue to be useful when the world is going to be so unstable relative to the last 30 years. I think that we're going to return to prosperity. We know how to do that. But what is unlikely to happen again is, it might happen, but I think it's unlikely to happen, is the kind of combination of prosperity and stability that really marked the last three decades. It's going to, in all likelihood, be a much more unstable and uncertain and perhaps difficult future for at least a period of time. And so what we need to do is to help them see that it is their very idealism, combined with the very hard-headed Stockdale paradox that we write about in Good to Great, of having faith in your ability to prevail, but combined with your discipline to confront the real stark realities that you face today, and to put those two together. I think that if we can help the younger generation embrace the Stockdale paradox while never losing their ideals, we could be useful to them.
Could you give a very quick recap of the Stockdale paradox?
Well, the Stockdale paradox is, for me, one of the more powerful ideas to come out of the Good to Great research. And it actually came from Admiral Jim Stockdale, and it was a pattern recognition of something Stockdale had said that then we really saw in the way our Good to Great leaders went about dealing with difficult circumstances and dealing with transforming their enterprises. And the essence of it is that Admiral Stockdale, who had been the highest-ranking military officer in the Hanoi Hilton from 1967 to 1974. He'd been shot down, and he had the burden of command responsibility in the camp and also just the challenge of getting through it himself. And when I asked Admiral Stockdale how he didn't get depressed in the camp, he responded that he had never wavered in his faith, not only that he would get out, but that he would turn it into a defining event of his life. And then later when I asked him okay, who didn't make it out as strong as you? And he said, the vulnerable ones were the optimists. And when I asked him to explain, he said that you should never confuse the need on the one hand for unwavering faith that you're going to find a way to prevail in the end, and you will turn any difficulty into a defining event. But you cannot confuse that end game faith with the need and the discipline to confront the most brutal facts, whatever they are. And you cannot delude yourself that you're going to be out by Christmas, because you might not be.
Something that's a much smaller question, perhaps, but that inspired a lot of chatter at EDUCAUSE is the creation of a list of not-to-dos.
Yeah.
How do you, in your busy life, manage to weed out those things that are not absolutely essential for you to continue to keep on your to-do list?
Number one, I have a stop-doing list, and that helps just to have it. Number two, every year when I sit down and do my annual priorities, and you should never have any more than three primary priorities, but for every primary priority, there has to be a corresponding stop doing. So it's a ledger. It's a balance. It's like accounts. You can't just have assets. You have to have assets and liabilities. And so for every primary priority, there has to be a corresponding stop doing priority, and they have to balance. The third is that I use ranking. So if I'm feeling overwhelmed by lots of things taking place, or we have lots of potential priorities, we'll sit around and rank them. Okay. We all agree these 11 things are good to do, but let's rank order them in importance from 1 to 11. And the interesting thing is that if you do that, most people will agree about what are 8, 9, 10, and 11, and you should just put them on the stop doing list. Rankings are a very powerful way to impose a sense of clarity. And then finally, closing back with Peter Drucker, Drucker had a wonderful question that he liked to ask of people about their businesses, but I think it applies to a range of activities. And it goes like this. If it were a decision today afresh, anew, to begin this activity, to launch this initiative, to introduce this legislation, to start this particular business, given everything you know now, if it were a fresh decision to start it, would you? And if the answer is no, then that's a good candidate for the stop doing list.
Jim Collins, we appreciate greatly your time with us today.
You're very welcome.
Jim Collins was a keynote speaker at the EDUCAUSE 2009 annual conference, and his latest book is How the Mighty Fall and Why Some Companies Never Give In. Be sure to download our full-length interview, which will be available beginning Monday, November 16th, on the EDUCAUSE iTunes channel and podcast page.
Lawrence Lessig is director of the Edward J. Safra Foundation Center for Ethics at Harvard University and a professor of law at Harvard Law School. He is also a founding board member of Creative Commons. His latest book is Remix, Making Art and Commerce Thrive in the Hybrid Economy. He spoke with Gardner Campbell, director for the Academy for Teaching and Learning at Baylor University, before his keynote address at this year's annual conference.
I wanted to start with a question about terms of service as perhaps the new criminalizer. And by that, I want to offer a specific example. Your primary focus in the book is copyright, of course, but I was wondering to what extent you see terms of service on a service like YouTube, for example, which explicitly forbid the use of any of the content in any way that's not there on the website, as a kind of new and stealthy criminalization of remix culture.
Well, I think that in principle, there's a problem created by the terms of service reaching far beyond what they need to in order to achieve their legitimate purpose. But it's less of a concern for me because the terms of service are enforced by contract, and the penalties for breaching a contract in this context are much less significant than the penalties for violating copyright. So that means that in theory, you're violating the rules, but the effective enforcement of those rules is going to be much less. And so I think that's a pretty significant difference here. Now, of course, they could shut your account down, and in some contexts that might be particularly significant. But that's the kind of limit of their enforcement, their sort of self-enforcement powers.
So why would YouTube have terms of service like that in the first place if it really is pretty much something that's not going to have too many consequences? And the question behind that is there a chilling effect that these terms of service would have on the ability even to claim fair use in an academic setting?
The reason to have the terms of service structured the way they do is to basically give the company an out whenever the company wants a way out. There's this meme going around right now about federal law. There's I don't know if you've seen this book, Three Felonies a Day, which basically says, you know, we constantly live life against the law, and there's all sorts of ways in which the government could prosecute us if they want. But, you know, we basically have to rely on the government not overreaching their hand. There's something similar going on with terms of service. Terms of service sets up all these conditions that give the company the right to kick you off if they want to kick you off. But they're not setting up terms of service because they think they're going to get a significant amount of revenue from individuals who might violate it. Now, on the other hand, if it were some company or some educational institution, the ability to demonstrate damages might be easier, but it depends on the facts. But my view is they're setting it up like that just so that they have the right. They constantly have a freedom to basically decide whether you get to stay on the system.
So on a very practical level, if a colleague comes to me at Baylor University and says, you know, I think it's really interesting, some of these videos up on YouTube, and I'd sure like to use them in my own work, but I'm not sure I can do that unless I'm actually on YouTube, and I'd rather not be on YouTube when I access this work. What would be the best recourse?
Well, you know, I think the other part of the question that you asked, and I didn't answer, is the chilling effect. And here's the way there is a chilling effect. You know, even if there's no ability to take legal recourse against somebody, many people believe, you know, they shouldn't violate the rules. So if the rules say you can't do something, they won't do it. Even if they did it, they wouldn't be effectively prosecuted. So the terms of service in that sense for the people who want to comply with the rules certainly do constrain or chill the opportunity to use this material in ways that, you know, one would expect that it should be used.
Well, and an even larger concern growing out of that in my own practice and in my own attempts to encourage my colleagues to adopt new media and to experiment with read-write culture and so forth has to do with the constant worry that fair use is essentially indefensible or that it's whatever your attorney can successfully defend on any particular day. And the response then is often to retreat behind the walled garden of a learning management system like Blackboard, let's say, or something that's password protected, and inevitably the result is that really interesting materials that could be remixed or that would have even greater value if they were out on the open web are locked away behind walled gardens. Could you talk a little bit about that in ways in which the sort of copyright issues and concerns have had a lot of collateral damage even within the sphere of teaching and learning in this way?
Well, I think especially copyright has had this collateral damage because there the risks are real. And, you know, if a university or a high school thinks about the exposure that they might be creating by encouraging this kind of remix activity, many of them, quite reasonably, will just say it's not worth it and you shouldn't be encouraging your students or your colleagues to engage in uses that aren't clearly permitted by the copyright owner. So people constantly say the law doesn't matter because people will violate the law. And what they have in their head is, you know, a 16-year-old kid who doesn't care much as he downloads stuff from his favorite peer-to-peer service. But when if you think about institutions and teachers and people inside of the educational system, they certainly will obey the rules. They're, you know, taught to obey the rules. They teach people to obey the rules. And so to the extent that the rules become salient to them, then it's going to constrain them in really important ways.
As the open education movement goes forward and we start to grapple with some of these problems, do you think that we're beginning to grapple with some of the fundamental assumptions in academic culture itself? Another way to ask that would be, in your book, you describe two different kinds of cultures, and one of them is a sharing culture. It's the culture of Lewis Hyde's The Gift. To what extent do you think institutional processes in academia have actually not only been fought shy of the technical issues in terms of sharing these works, but also encouraged a kind of culture of retreat, one that's not really devoted to sharing, one that's kind of paranoid about ideas getting out and so forth. And I put that in a very extreme way, but I'm interested to what extent it's almost baked into the community, in your view, a certain culture of shying away from sharing.
Well, I think that this community, like any community, has people who are not committed to sharing or object to sharing and like to hoard and imagine that, you know, their idea is going to be turned into some movie and they'll make millions of dollars from it or whatever. I don't have a sense that it's greater in our community. I think it's in fact less. It's more ignorance in the narrow sense of just people not thinking about the issue that inhibits this practice than it is a kind of, you know, true resistance to it. Now, I don't think that excuses it, because I think, you know, we should actually, we do have a strong ethical obligation to try to fix this problem and get it going in a way that will encourage the use and spreading of this material in a way that makes sense. But it means that it's not going to be as hard a problem as it is to think about convincing record label executives about, you know, a different way to make and spread culture. I think when you begin to have the conversation, people get it. And the best evidence for that, I think, is that when we started with the Creative Commons project, when we started getting educators to adopt the Creative Commons licenses to encourage open education, the first instinct of many people was, you know, a relatively restrictive license. But I think that the history of adoption has seen increasingly relaxed license adoption and migrating from a more restrictive license to a less restrictive license as people reflect upon what makes sense for the enterprise and begin to practice it. So I'm encouraged that we can make a lot of progress here, but I think we need to speak frankly about, you know, influences that have limited it and try to get around those as quickly as we can.
Well, Professor Lessig, thanks for your thoughts and thanks for you, okay?
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Lawrence Lessig was a keynote speaker at the EDUCAUSE 2009 annual conference. And his latest book is Remix, Making Art and Commerce Thrive in the Hybrid Economy. Be sure to download our full-length interview, which will be available beginning Monday, November 16th on the EDUCAUSE iTunes channel and podcast page. Thanks for joining us for EDUCAUSE Now, which, by the way, was just awarded a 2009 Digital ASBE Gold for Issue-Oriented Podcast from the American Society of Business Publication Editors. Congratulations, Jerry.
Well, thanks a lot. I appreciate it, and we appreciate you listening.
If you'd like to find more EDUCAUSE podcasts, visit our iTunes channel by searching for EDUCAUSE, or find our podcasts on the web at www.educause.edu/podcasts.
I'm Jerry Bain for EDUCAUSE Now.
I'm Colleen Luckett. Thanks for listening.